This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
Here's a little bit by way of summary of what we talked about so far in these the first two sessions in discussing these things. We said that governments are necessary. You got to have government. And this is for practical reasons. I mean, just got to have some kind of government. We said that there was no God-given revelation that said, very specifically, here's exactly the form of government you should have. Here's exactly the type. Here's how it ought to be structured. In fact, here's a sample constitution. There is no first constitutions in the Bible, right? We don't have anything that specific that tells you in particular exactly what it should look like. So we said that there's a problem with every type of government on the face of the earth. Everyone and every kind of one has a problem. And what's the problem? Right here. This guy right here. And all of you peoples all there. It's everybody. It's the fact is, even a good guy. You know, a lot of blood. A lot of blood on the ground. And that's just the worst of it, is the bloody stuff. Even short of the bloody stuff is all the corruption. And the mistakes. And the power grabs. You know, just the stuff that happens because we're dealing with human beings. Even a good government, for the people, by the people. Well, it's just, you got the people involved, and the people are the problem. So as long as you got the people, it'll be imperfect. And we said that the Bible's main interest in when it comes to political leaders is not the technicalities and the nuts and bolts of how they do the job. It's character. That's what we mostly read when God deals with kings and rulers and judges. He never sends a prophet to a king that says, your taxation, your tax market margins are not what they should be. Also, let's talk about those exporting policies. And another thing, you know, it's like, no, the prophet, he goes to kings to say, this place is corrupt. You take bribes. You oppress the poor people in your midst. You're a bad dude. I mean, it's always that the person's character is at fault, pretty much. So, and then last week we were talking about church and state being separate. And remember, we said they're clearly distinct, but they're not separate in the sense that a lot of people today think. They're not perfect strangers to each other, and they're also not enemies. But we said that the founder's main interest was to protect the church. To protect the free worship of people in their churches without harassment, without coercion, and without the government on their backs. That was their main interest. That's what they were most into. That was what drove their urgency to make sure that the very first part of that bill that had all those guarantees in it, you know, the very first, right up top, was, don't worry, we're not gonna infringe. And that's over time been changed. So all of these things go together. So the question for tonight then is America a Christian nation? Thought we might deal with that. Is America a Christian nation? And of course, as is often the case, and I almost feel like apologizing. I hate to have to say it so often, but it's just a fact. This question, like lots of questions, needs more clarification. I know that gets old, but the answer to this question depends a lot on what you mean by it. I feel like I say that all the time to people. What do you mean by that? Well, help me understand what your question is really asking before I can give an answer. Remember what I talked one week about getting trapped into simplistic yes-no questions? You know? Yes or no? Yes or no? Well, I feel like I can't really just give you a straight yes or no until I'm more sure what you're asking. Otherwise, it might breed confusion. And so in this case, for example, the person might be asking, are we a Christian nation? And they might be asking this in a kind of official sense. In an official sense. I mean, if they had lived in other parts of the world and at other times, they might ask you that question, and what they might be wondering is, what's your national church? In that case, if they're asking it that way, we're saying the answer is no. I mean, the answer is no if they mean, do we have a state religion? Our government did not intend to endorse officially or be the head of any denomination. They were darn sure. All the signers of these documents came from different denominations. And they were going to make sure that they had had enough of what the Anglicans were all about. Most of them came from there. they didn't want the Anglican church. I mean, they had just thrown off the head of that, because the king is the head of that church, King of England. And they had pretty much broken the ties with him. And so they weren't going to be officially Anglican. But they also weren't going to let the Presbyterian, the Congregationalist, or any of them put the official stamp. So there's not going to be, the framers said, obviously the nation isn't a church, that sort of goes without saying, but it also wasn't going to house a national church where, let's say, you employ state-sponsored ministers. So you have clergy that are, you know, they're clerics and they work for the government, and the government appoints them. They were not going to do that. Europe had plenty of that. Yes, even long after the Reformation. They just didn't know any other way to do it. It was so steeped in the culture for so many years that coming out of the medieval era, that's just everyone assumed government is official. What's that?
Some of these American states
certainly did. Like the European states. Before the federal government was formed, and even a little bit afterwards, but they kind of ended up fading away. But yeah, some of the states. Now, there was some fighting in those too. I mean, some of those states, you can well imagine, well, what's it going to be? But in other words, it was a little bit radical to say we're not going to have an official state church. For in the minds of most of them, this was a fresh, new, and bold idea. Even though for us, it seems like the only idea we ever lived with and that we can conceive of, really. So we have to stretch our minds to think about living under a state church. Imagine the government knows your church attendance, knows what you give, you know. Maybe they just take it right out of your taxes. Maybe part of your taxes that you pay just goes right to the church. That's how it would work. And in a theocratic type of system, that's what you get. We have a hard time imagining that. They sure didn't. They knew what that was about. So if we're asking officially, do you have a state church? Is that what is meant by the question? Then the answer is no. However, more generally speaking, if we're talking about the core ideas, the fundamental type of beliefs, well, then we have to think about that a little differently. The framers and the founders and all those early guys presumed the very basic values and worldview that is consistent with Christian beliefs. The basic ones, I mean, shared by all the denominations. I mean, very basic things. Sort of like the things that the Apostles' Creed would outline. They all would sign on to that, and these kind of ideas were a part of their roots. They wouldn't have imagined cutting those roots, and they thought it necessary to fully support a healthy church life, a healthy religious life of the citizens. There are endless quotes where they're saying we don't want an official state church, but we want all the churches out there to thrive. That's why we're not going to bug them. That's why we're going to be off their backs. And they're going to have total freedom. And we hope that they will teach good principles and, you know, the fundamental beliefs that a citizen needs. That was sort of what they had in mind. That's how they thought of it. But now, not everyone is satisfied with this way of approaching it, where you say, well, okay, officially, no. On the other hand, we've come a long way, haven't we, since then? I mean, society has moved a long way just in the way people generally think from the time of the founding. And so, when we are just
out and about, and we were just reading the general commentary of the world, we will get different ideas about this. So what do we say then about, just to show you an example?
Well, at Midwest City, you can hardly drive a mile without passing three or four churches.
We live in the Bible Belt.
Yeah.
So we may not notice this as much, because we still have a lot of church-going people. But, frankly, a lot of church-going people have let themselves just believe the stuff that the world tells them. And I think a lot of church-going people just think, yeah, well, I guess we're a secular nation, so I'm going to be real careful. Because, you know, I don't want to violate that separation of church and state. So that's, I'm going to keep it real quiet. You know, not infringe on anyone's rights. So in other words, they're still taking their cues on these things from sort of the loudest bullhorns today. And so here's an article I'll just show you, the headline here. From the Huffington Post, okay? The Huffington Post. This is just one example.
Written by John Adams.
What's that?
Written by John Adams.
Yes. So there you go. I mean, you know, it's just as simple as that. Founding fathers say, you know, we are not a Christian nation. That's what the founding fathers say. I mean, after all, just look at how they highlighted that little section there by John Adams. The government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. Well, there you go. Sounds like David might know something about this quote. You probably do. If so, I bet you'll know where it came from. This one gets referenced quite a bit by sort of the purveyors of the secularist view, that we were founded to be totally secular and Christianity is, you know, this annoying barnacle that sort of stuck to us. And the founders were just, they wouldn't have wanted any part of this because, after all, separation. Yeah. Did you find where that's from?
Well, it says it's a John Adams quote, but it starts out, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people." It is wholly inadequate to govern any other. The government of the United States is not, in any sense, founded on Christian religion. When the legislature is corrupted, the people are undone.
So, somebody actually, more than one person has, but someone interesting took people to task for using this quote all the time. And what makes the person interesting that I found is that the person is a very outspoken secularist. And I think I even have the full. Let me shrink this down. I'll see if I can find this on my own. Let me see if I can come up with this. I had found the fuller version. I can show you. In fact, I have on a slide the beginnings of it, where it starts. Secularists. This is his title. This guy wrote this title. "Secularists, please stop quoting the Treaty of Tripoli." That's where that line comes from, that Adams line, where he says it's not founded on the... It comes from the thing called the Treaty of Tripoli. Now, you're thinking, what? So you can even see his opening line. This guy is an ardent secularist, an outspoken secularist. He says, you know, that he's been to a lot of secular conferences, and he says, "Someone will always bring up the Treaty of Tripoli," in that quote. He says, "I'm writing today to beseech my fellow secularists with a simple request. Please, for the love of God, in the colloquial sense, stop quoting the Treaty of Tripoli." Now, why does he think, being the kind of guy he is, why does he think they shouldn't? Well, he gives a little bit of background on what the treaty is. You know, this was something that took place during the Adams administration when there were these issues with the Barbary coast, as they called it, the Barbary nations, these African nations, you know how they've always had trouble with pirates. We still got trouble with pirates, right? It's the Somalis. Well, they had a lot of trouble with it, and Britain had made a pact with them, had made this treaty with them, saying that, you know, basically the treaty was they paid them. Britain was paying these nations not to send pirates, not to take their ships. These were important shipping lanes, in other words. And so they basically paid them off, in a sense. But the problem is, America was no longer part of Britain. America was now independent. So that old treaty did not hold anymore, the original one. So America had ships that were being attacked by pirates in these areas. So they formed their own treaty with these people. Again, basically paying them protection money to say, you know, in order to use that...
Leave our ships alone.
Yeah. To use that part of the coast that those guys patrolled or the waters they were in. And so what the guy ends up saying is, okay, that's the context of it. But the thing is, even this secularist writer says, it's dishonest the way we're using this. Because what he's trying to say, and if this cooperated with me, I would be able to read the entire line from this. For some reason, I can't make this work. This tablet of mine, I'm on the page, but I can't make it work at all. So, but what he's doing is, I can summarize what it is. What Adams is doing in the fuller quote of this is he's trying to say to them, they're Muslims, these Barbary nations. He's trying to say to them, we are not officially Christian the way that you are officially Muslim. In other words, there is no Christian-Muslim animosity here. We can do business and be friends with what he calls like Mohammedan nations. You know, they kind of use older terms for it. Because we're not heading out on our ships with a Christian flag. You know what I mean? This isn't what's going on here. In fact, they later rewrote the treaty in 1805 because they broke it. Some pirates broke it, and they had to go back and revisit it. Actually, they had to fight them a little bit. You ever notice in the Marine Corps song, it talks about the shores of Tripoli, you know? So they rewrote it in 1805, and it's interesting, when they redid it in 1805, they basically wrote it almost the same. They left that part out. So even by then, they felt like maybe that was too strong a thing for Adams to say when he said we are not founded on the Christian religion. But if you're able to read the whole context of what he writes, which unfortunately I cannot read to you because this thing's frozen. Yeah. So I'm through with that, I guess. Yeah, I know. I'm just about, you know what, Bill, I'm almost there. I'm real close to just doing exactly what you just said. Yeah, this thing's gonna get frisbeed right out into the street. I don't abide malfunctioning technology very well. So anyway, but there you have it. So, but now, of course, if you go looking for lots of quotes like this that would support the idea that the founders repudiated their Christian roots, you know, and they sought to found a nation on philosophical principles other than the basic Christian principles that they're raised with, if you're looking for quotes that say that, I mean, you can take that one from Adams that we saw. You can take that and go as far as you want with it. Even the secularist writer is saying we should be more honest and not take that out of context. By the way, the secular writer in the fuller piece he wrote, which I wish I could read to you, he says, now look, guys, we got to be honest. Here's a bunch of other stuff Adams said. And he read stuff kind of like what David read a minute ago and plenty more things. To say, let's not give the false impression that this is how Adam saw things. So, if we're talking quotes, though, quotes abound, you know this, when it comes to how the founders saw this stuff. if we could ask them, are we a Christian nation? I think, based on everything that I could tell, I think they would say what we said a minute ago. I think they would say, officially, of course not. We will never have an official church. We will be a free and open playing field for all churches to thrive. However, I think they would be quick to say that, yeah, the core principles on which this whole thing was constructed are clearly Christian principles. And
well,
I,
Pennsylvania was started by a Quaker.
Yeah, good old Willie Penn. Yeah. In fact, a lot of the early colonies were founded on in this way. I mean, not just Quakers. Remember I talked about Roger Williams, the Baptist, founder of Rhode Island, strong advocate for religious freedom. We've talked before about all of the early Ivy League schools. Do a search of the foundings of Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Dartmouth, Brown. One at a time, look at all of them, and they're considered the Ivy League. And what will you find? All founded by certain denominations, all having ministers as their presidents for the first several generations, all with Christian mottos. Some of them still have, often in Latin, with the name of Christ in them still. And like evangelistic sounding stuff about their mission or stuff written in their early constitutions about how they want to train ministers to change the world. I mean, that's where they all came from. So listen to a few things, though, that sort of let us know some of these things about how the founders saw the principles again. So let's see. So Washington, he says, to the distinguished character of patriot, it should be our highest glory to add the more distinguished character of Christian. He says in another place, he's talking to the Delaware Indian chiefs in 1779 about the schools. They could send their kids to the schools. And as part of that, he says, what students would learn in American schools, above all, is the religion of Jesus Christ. If you said that today, are you kidding me? I mean, and so in his farewell address, Washington said, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle. A common theme with these guys is that we really want this nation grounded in these high moral virtues, but we will not have them. That will not last if we become unspiritual, if we become paganized. It won't last. It's got, so long as we have a good, strong Christian voice helping to rear people and raise people, we have a shot that they might maintain the virtues we expect. We throw that out, and it's like saying, hey, I got rid of my sprinkler system, and I live in Phoenix, but I just expect my garden to grow. It's not going to happen. So here's some more from Adams. He says, I have examined all religions, and this is in a letter to Jefferson, as well as my narrow sphere, my straitened means, my busy life would allow. And the result is that the Bible is the best book in the world. It contains more philosophy than all the libraries I have seen. He also says the general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. I will avow that I believed and now believe that those general principles of Christianity are as eternal and immutable as the existence and attributes of God. And even Jefferson, who's a little bit deist in his approach, said, got something on that?
Well, it's related to all of this. You may know, I don't know, I heard that somewhere back there it came to a vote whether or not the Bible was going to be the principal textbook in the public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And
they voted no. Yeah, I'm not familiar with the vote. There are a few lines on that, actually, I think. I'm see if I may have something on that.
Well, that wasn't a good sign. That's not a good sign.
That wouldn't. Yeah, and we will say something in a minute about the affiliation of all these guys. It's known. It's not a mystery. Each of them, their affiliation. Where did they go to church? What covenants had they signed as far as covenant membership in different places? But Jefferson, who is no evangelical, but sort of still just had some of the basic core beliefs, he says, God who gave us liberty, is God who gave us liberty, can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, which is a conviction in the minds of people that these liberties are a gift from God? He said, of all the systems of morality, ancient or modern, which have come under my observation, none appears to me so pure as that of Jesus. And then, of course, there's a famous one that's on the walls of the Jefferson Memorial, if you go to the nation's capital, where he says, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his justice cannot sleep forever. Talking about his own nation's sins. And so John Quincy Adams, the son of Second President, said, who himself was a president, said, is it not that in the chain of human events, the birthday of the nation is indissolubly linked with the birthday of the Savior, that it forms a leading event in the progress of the gospel dispensation? Is it not that the Declaration of Independence first organized the social compact on the foundation of the Redeemer's mission on earth, that it laid the cornerstone of human government upon the first precepts of Christianity? Madison said, before any man can be considered as a member of civil society, he must be considered as a subject of the governor of the universe. And then Franklin said this. He said, I've lived, sir, he was actually writing to Madison, I think, I've lived, sir, a long time. And the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I have seen of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. If a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We've been assured in the sacred writings that unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. Again, and that's from Franklin, who, again, is usually identified as a deist. So, now, when it comes to... Here's another thing we have to address, as I mentioned a second ago. When we're talking about the founders... Often what we sometimes hear from people who really want to push back against the Christian influences that were fundamental to who they were, the Christian influences that sort of found their way in everything that they talk about in all those quotes, they'll say, well, yeah, but look, here's the thing. The founders, they weren't Christians. They were a bunch of deists. Now, have you ever heard that one? They're a bunch of deists. What is a deist is a question we have to... I didn't put this on the slide. D-E-I-S-T, a deist. Now, this is a specific term referring to a kind of a way of belief. Now, deism, I should add, is not officially a religion. There was never, to my knowledge anyway, a church of deism or a deist theology or deist doctrine or deist ministers or anything like that. Deism was more... a term applied to a philosophical perspective, but it was a theistic philosophical perspective. And as best, sort of like, well, in brief, where it came from is, deism was what resulted when certain scholars and intellectuals in the late Middle Ages, starting in the late Middle Ages, started to make advances. So you had the scientific revolution. Remember all those guys? Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo. And then you had a bunch of other things. And then a philosophical movement they called the Enlightenment. A flurry of activity. Lots of writings about all these subjects. And sort of a new philosophical interest. some of those, not all by any means, but some, and especially in France, there were some who part of this new way of thinking turned against the traditional church. In France, the French Enlightenment was more prone to this because they really hated the church more over there, because in France, the church had a lot more, a tighter grip and was seen as much more oppressive. Remember, this is where they had major revolution eventually. And the church, remember, the church was part of the First Estate. They were the big landowners. They hoarded all the money. So over there, it was more common to dislike the church. And the philosophers were like, yeah, and another thing is Christianity. They turned on it. So deism was what happened when they wanted to sort of jettison Christian ideas, some Christian ideas, but they were not going to be atheists. That's the difference. Because it was still too evident to them that there must be a God. So what they did is they redefined and re-understood God, the deists did. And they said, well, to us, God is sort of like more what Plato had in mind, which is he is supreme, he's great and super powerful, knows everything, created everything, but, you know, he didn't really necessarily care what's going on. He doesn't necessarily like love you and watch you and care about you and pay attention to your life and worry about your little problems and listen to your prayers. He doesn't run around doing miracles. Because you know, it sounds unscientific to go talking about miracles. And they saw themselves as enlightened, some of these guys. So that's what deism basically was. It was God without miracles. It was God, the clockmaker. He built the machine. He instituted natural laws, which is morality. And then he said, my work here is done. And then he's up there somewhere. And he'll still judge you someday. I mean, don't get me wrong. He's still watching. But, you know, so that's kind of, it was just a trend. It was a movement. You notice, you know, it didn't last that long because, now there are some people that probably think like that today, actually. But it was more trendy. So when people say, well, the founders were just deists, that's what they're referring to. That's what they're referring to.
Mm-hmm. Remember Elijah? Oh, make more noise. Maybe Jesus.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
And then if you read, and the thing is, because a lot of the founders were influenced by European thinkers of the Enlightenment, guys like John Locke, they quote Locke a lot. But here's the thing, Locke really wasn't a deist himself. One of Locke's writings, the British philosopher, one of his writings was entitled The Reasonableness of Christianity. Now, he still emphasized reason a lot, but he didn't throw out everything. He still believed in Christian doctrine. And a lot of them did, but some didn't. So some people can't make the distinction. Now, I studied a lot of this stuff, so I kind of know who did and who didn't, because I spent a lot of time on it. And
Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of
Yeah, see, Jefferson is one of those that they'll say, oh, well, he kind of leans deist. He leans that way more than most of the others, and so does Franklin. But you just heard some quotes from those guys. And so what I say to that accusation is, well, they're all just a bunch of deists anyway. So I say, well, even if it were true, what does it really buy the secularists? What does it really get you as a secularist who wants to scrub America of Christian influence? Because even if I were to say they were all deists, if they were Jeffersonian deists, if they were Franklin-type deists, the secularists wouldn't like that either. You just heard what I said. You just heard what I read. They'd be mad. Imagine Franklin and imagine today a ticket. Franklin and Jefferson, vote for them. After they said stuff like that, forget it. They'd be called super right-wing nut jobs and fundamentalists for saying that, even though they were the most deist, probably. Or they, you know, most of the other guys were not nearly that deist. They were much more explicitly Christian. Incidentally, you want to know, here's an interesting tidbit of history, by the way. one of the most prominent Methodists in America, without a doubt, was George Whitefield. And that's just because he came and traveled and spoke to massive crowds. He was some... one writer I read recently, a scholar at Baylor, wrote a biography of him, of Whitefield. Calls Whitefield America's first true celebrity. Now, all the papers knew who he was. They reprinted his sermons. He had the biggest crowds in the world. And the funny thing is, Whitefield, among his circle of friends, was one Benjamin Franklin. It was Franklin's press that printed all Whitefield's material and sent and circulated it. And the two had a good friendship and really respected each other. And what Whitefield spent most of his time doing, and they both admitted this, they knew it, there were no secrets here, was trying to further evangelize Franklin. Because he felt like Franklin was smart. He felt like Franklin respected the Bible and believed in God. But, you know, I mean, for an evangelist like Whitefield, you ain't all the way home until you have 100% repented of your sin and embraced Jesus. I mean, you know, so Whitefield basically went full evangelist, and they both knew it, and they both were fine with it. And Franklin would give him interesting responses. Well, you know, and he'd make jokes about it. You know, Whitefield's trying to convert me further, you know. But he wasn't offended. He wasn't mad at him by any means. So.
And he didn't change any of his texts that he wrote.
He was happy to print them out. He thought the world of Whitefield. I mean, he thought he was a completely honorable, saintly type of man, you know. But look, even if they had all been deists. In fact, let's take a step further. This is just a good thought experiment in the exchange if you're talking to someone who has this point of view. Even let's say for the sake of argument that it were true that they were all not even the Franklin type deists. Let's say they were all the kind of deists that didn't talk, quote the Bible. They did believe that God created everything, and they did believe that God, you know, wrote the moral laws that we should live by, and that someday we will answer. Is today's modern secularist even going to put up with that? I don't even know if they'd let that go. They might be mad at you for even saying that, especially officially in any way, like especially publicly, especially if a politician started talking that way. So I don't know what gets them.
The State Health Department, the commissioner said, no Christmas trees. Yeah.
Don't you dare go offending them with your tree. But the fact of the matter is, you see, it's not true that they were mostly deists. I mean, now, sometimes people will read the way they talk because they, you know, people talk differently in different eras, right? So when you read, I love how they write. It's funny to me. I mean, it's just interesting. I like how they do. Well, you should read what the stuff, even their correspondences. You can read all the letters that, like, for example, Adams and Jefferson wrote back and forth all the time to each other. Sometimes they wrote friendly stuff. Sometimes they wrote disagreeing stuff. And the others did too. When you read everything they wrote, it's quaint. It's different. It's old-timey. It sounds different. So they don't write like we do. They don't say, hey, yo, George, man, what up? You know, they speak in these terms. And when they talk about all these deep subjects, especially God, the Bible, all these things, they use terms that European scholars use, that European thinkers, that those guys use. So they will sound like Locke and Hobbes and, you know, these guys in Europe. And so because they will use language like that, like, for example, they talk about providence a lot. Well, that's just God's activity, God's will. We in church evangelicals today would say, God's doing things. God's active. God's doing great things. You know, they talk like that. These guys would have said, the hand of providence is moving. The hand of providence moved. That's just how they talked. Now, that's sometimes how deists talked too. You know what I mean? They shared some lingo. So, but we know how they affiliated. So, for example, when it comes to the founders, when it comes to who signed the Declaration, that's the first one. All the names of everyone who signed the Declaration. 88 were Anglican/Episcopalian, because, you know, the Episcopal Church is, you know how that works. 30 of them are Presbyterians. 27 were Congregationalists, 7 were Quakers, 6 were Dutch or German Reformed, 5 Lutherans, 3 Catholics, 3 Huguenots, those are French Calvinists. Then you had 3 Unitarians, 2 Methodists, and 1 just identified as Calvinist. So, now, you know, you have to understand, when they were members of these churches officially back in those times, they signed covenants. I mean, they put their names on covenants and agreed to theology, doctrinal statements. So in other words, when they list the affiliations of these guys, it's not as if it's just like, well, they attended sometimes, or that's just the church they kind of went to sometimes. No, they're saying they meant it.